Good afternoon. This is KDVS 90.3. This is a public affairs show called Books and Ideas. I am DJ Safikar. We're broadcasting not far from where the village of Putatoy once stood, inhabited by Patwin Native Americans. I want to make a small announcement before we go on with today's show. You may have heard that this past weekend, Han Kang was awarded the 2024 Nobel Prize in Literature, becoming the first Korean writer and the first Asian writer to win this award. I became so happy and proud, and I'm not Korean. My name is Muhammad. But it felt like an Iranian woman had won it, or someone from Arden Arcade. Anyhow, so in her honor, we will review and discuss one of her works, namely The Vegetarian, in this show in a few weeks. But before we look at this work, and after we're done with this nail book that we're looking at now, we will get into the works of Korean-German philosopher Byung-Chul Han, starting with his first seminal work, The Burnout Society, published in 2015. So that's what's coming up in this show in the next few weeks. This is the third week that we're looking at the sounds of a wild snail eating, The Earthly Adventures of a Woman and a Gastropod by Elizabeth Tova Bailey, first published in 2010. This book is about 1 year in the life of an author, Elizabeth Tova Bailey, when she becomes bedridden from an unknown illness, and how she's able to find meaning and strength through companionship with a wild snail, despite the many hardship she faced. A friend brings in a snail with a pot of violets. At first, Elizabeth is uninterested and wonders what to do with it. But the snail grows on her. It is nocturnal, and Elizabeth hears it eating late at night. She becomes curious about the snail and its life and begins watching it very closely. She finds out many things about the snail by watching it, but her observation also brings forth many questions. She turns to science and literature to find some answers. What she finds out is truly astonishing. The first few chapters dealt with Elizabeth's initial observations of the snail. The next chapters deal with the physiology and biology of the snail. Last time we covered the snail's teeth, its tentacles or horns, its navigation system, and its spiral shell. We will conclude the discussion of the biology of a snail today and move on to other aspects of its life. The book is about the rewards of closely observing nature. It shows that anything can be the subject of our intellectual curiosity. It is about how zooming in and focusing on a small part of natural world can illuminate our own human existence. We're at chapter 10, called Secret Recipes. Land snails have come out of the ocean. It was hundreds of millions of years ago that some marine snails evolved certain traits that allowed them to colonize land. They developed a mucus of slime as a way to prevent dehydration and to be able to move about easily in their terrestrial habitats. While slime can certainly be disgusting, Bailey writes, it hadn't occurred to me that it might be interesting. When healthy, Elizabeth had experienced firsthand the difficulty of getting the slime of slugs off her hands after working in the garden. It took pumice stone and 400 grit sandpaper to get the stuff off. Yet it's precisely because of their slime that terrestrial gastropods have thrived. She writes, "My snail secreted a special kind of slime for locomotion called pedal mucus, over which it traveled, while its ability to glide over a patch of moss appeared effortless. When it went up a glass side of the terrarium, I could see bands of minute ripples moving along the underside of its foot. These ripples momentarily turn the mucus from solid to liquid, disrupting friction, allowing the snail to advance at a speed of a few inches per minute. Petal mucus is an incredible adhesive. It explains the snail's ability to cross over soft mosses, hang upside down along a leaf, or sleep, oblivious to gravity, high on the side of the glass terrarium, or dangling from the tip of the fern frond. It also has other crucial functions. Snails have 8 different types of secreting glands, and they can release different kinds of mucus depending on their needs. If they're disturbed, the slime will become foamy and smelly. If they're injured, it will have antibiotics in it, and so on and so on. In other words, its pharmacy is on its back. The snail will often reuse its own or another snail's trail in order to save on slime production. By detecting pheromones on a trail, they can determine whether it leads to a foe, friend, or potential mate. In part 4, Bailey's book, Bailey looks at what she refers to as snail's cultural life. So chapter 11 is called Colonies of Hermits. Elizabeth thought a diet of portobellos alone was probably boring, so she made her snail a porridge of cornstarch and cornmeal. She found the recipe in a pamphlet from the Cooperative Extension Office. The snail loves it, but it overeats. This was a big mistake, she writes. It climbed in a staggering sort of a way to the top of a terrarium, clearly suffering from a severe case of indigestion. It stayed there for hours, exerting waste from all orifices. Bailey becomes terribly worried about what if the snail doesn't recover from the overindulgence. She wonders selfishly, how will she survive her illness without the snail at her companion? It was a miserable night for both of us, she recounts. I resolved never again to feed it anything unnatural. The next morning, she was relieved to find the snail moving about normally and following its usual routine, wandering off to doze off in a soft, mossy corner of terrarium. Indeed, woodland snails are most often found among the debris of a leaf litter that covers the forest floor. Snails are best known as decomposers because they feed primarily on dead leaf matter, thus filling a niche in the ecosystem by returning nutrients to the soil. Snails also possess a special enzyme that allows them to digest cellulose. This is how Elizabeth Snail could eat paper products with such ease. Other species of snails love to graze on algae, and still others will munch contentedly on mushrooms, even those that are toxic to humans. Foraging of snails is complex. They vary their diets to balance their nutrients intake. 2 snails of the same species in the same location may take different dining arrangements depending on their own individual needs. Soil is also an important part of snail's diet, providing it much-needed nutrients such as calcium, which are essential not only for shell's growth and repair, but also for egg production. Calcium is so critical for snail, it is the only known land animal able to smell it and find it by smell. After her caregiver placed eggshells in a terrarium, Elizabeth notices her own snail's rapid response. At first, her snail waved its tentacles rapidly. Then it set off as fast as it can to investigate and start eating immediately. Elizabeth noticed from this point on that the eggshell corner became one of her snail's favorite places. Another place her snail liked to spend a lot of time was near the shell of a fresh mussel. The snail usually drank straight from the small basin, but sometimes it climbed right inside, flattening its foot into the shell's pearly contours and absorbing water directly through its skin, a hydration method known as foot drinking. Wild snails will usually forage downwind from their daytime sleeping places. Young snails will travel 5 times farther than other older snails to find food or establish their own colony. However, most snails tend to live out their lives in close proximity to where they hatch. Colonies of snails are often confined by natural barriers and the terrain of their location. As species, microenvironment might be as site-specific as hillside or a valley or even a clump of leaves drifted against a log or a damp area between rocks. Populations may number 100 individuals, though they can be much smaller, or if the habitat is contiguous and extended for miles, much larger. When Elizabeth considered the distance her snail could travel in relation to its size, her own immobility seemed stark in comparison. She admits, "My life was becoming nearly as solitary as my snails." As the months drifted by, it became harder for friends to give up weekend time to make the long drive to visit. There were many days when I saw a caregiver for just half an hour at meal times, and I was becoming more and more cut off from the world. My bed was an island within the desolate sea of my room. Yet I knew there were other people homebound from illness or injury, scattered here and there throughout the rural towns and cities around the world. As I lay there, I felt the connection to all of them. We too were a colony of hermits. Chapter 12 is called Midnight Leap. Bailey begins the chapter with the story of when she was in better health. Years ago, one night, she awoke with a strong thirst. On the way to the kitchen sink, she slipped on a tiny slug, finding her body high up in the air. She speculates that her cat probably brought it in on its fur. Excuse me. But now, years later, she thinks about it once again in another context. The size of the slug was tiny in comparison to her own size, yet its defense mechanism was enough to protect it from a much larger creature. Though its own weight was much less than a sixth of an ounce, it easily and passively repelled my 100 pounds with its slime and unperturbed continued on its way. She asks, if I were to encounter an animal as large, what would I do for defense? And how would I escape? She cannot think of a single passive human defense method as brilliant as slime. Bailey writes, 3.5 billion years ago, when life on Earth began, the snail and I shared a common ancestor, some kind of a simple worm that over time evolved into two animal groups. The protostomes, which is the embryonic stage developed a mouth first and then an anus, branched off into gastropod and the species of the snail at my side, and the deuterostomes, which developed the same characteristics, though somewhat embarrassingly in reverse order, anus first and then a mouth, and branched off into mammals, including Homo sapiens. Regarding our anatomy, snails and humans have some things in common. We both have a stomach, heart, and lung. Snails have one lung compared to our two lungs, but this is where our similarity ends. In 1862, Charles Darwin wrote to the geologist Charles Lyell, "I should think mammals and mollusks rather too remote from each other for fair comparison." Bailey seemingly agrees. After observing the snail's quirky telescoping eye noses, ribbon-like teeth, slimy skin, and movable house, she admits it was hard to believe that we originated on the same planet. Yet as Elizabeth delves deeper into the dusty mollusk volumes, she discovers that gastropods, which account for approximately 80% of all mollusks, are one of the most successful animal groups. She writes, they have existed for 500 million years, surviving or re-evolving through several mass extinction events. They make their home in nearly every habitat on Earth. While 35,000 living terrestrial snail species have been documented so far, tens of thousands still are yet to be identified. The majority of these yet-to-be-identified snails are microscopic, as Ernest Ingersoll points out in his 1881 essay in a Snailery. He writes, some of the snail species are so minute that they would not hide the letter O in this print. Bailey observes, if we Homo sapiens thought we were in charge of the planet, here's a clear evidence to the contrary. She writes, the humble snail and his clan have a far older and stickier foothold on the earth than we more recent creatures. It was clear to me that gastropods should make front page headlines in the New York Times, and mammals, particularly the human sort, should be relegated to back sections. But then, with its many teeth, radula, cellulose, digesting enzymes, and lack of vision, my snail was more likely to eat the Times than to read it. Elizabeth wonders, with a home range measured in yards and a locomotive speed of a few inches per minute, how did terrestrial snails colonize world's continents? As it turned out, it wasn't just her cat that provided high-speed slug transport. In the literature, Bailey comes across the story of Tim Pierce. Pierce is a a person specializing in study of mollusks. While studying the range of gastropod, Pierce tracked the nocturnal adventures of a group of snails by attaching a thread to each of their shells. He discovered one snail is moved alive 27 yards by a shrew, with its journey ending more than 3 feet below ground in a burrow. Bailey speculates that her snail's ancestor probably also caught unexpected rides on the hides of dinosaurs, or fur of giant sloths, or saber-toothed cats. While this may explain how snails colonized the Earth's continents, none of these transport methods explain how terrestrial snails came to colonize islands far in sea. This problem greatly vexed Charles Darwin. On September 28, 1856, he wrote to the naturalist Philip Goss, "The means of transport of land mollusca utterly puzzles me." A few days later, writing to his cousin, the naturalist William Fox, Darwin states, "No subject gives me so much trouble and doubt and difficulty as means of dispersal to oceanic islands. Land mollusca drive me mad." And clearly, they did drive him mad. For that December, Darwin wrote to the botanist Joseph Hooker, complaining, "I have for the last 15 months been tormented and haunted by land mollusca." In 1859, in The Origin of Species, Darwin wondered if a hibernating snail might be able to float on a piece of wood across the sea. Bailey writes, "This set him off on his usual method of scientific inquiry, experiments. Darwin filled containers with ocean water and obtained a collection of live and hibernating snails. He put one snail into seawater for 20 days, and it recovered perfectly. During this length of time, the shell might have been carried by a marine current for average swiftness to a distance of 660 geographical miles." Satisfied with his results, Darwin confided to Joseph Hooker, "I feel as if 1,000-pound weight was taken off my back." We now know that Darwin's dispersal theories have been proven to be true. But in Elizabeth's case, it was just a chance encounter. It was only a chance that her snail's path had crossed with that of her friend, much less the sort of a friend who would bend over and pick up a snail as a gift for a convalescing friend. Bailey notes, the history of gastropod travel now includes the unexpected journey of my own snail, which had arrived at my bedside by human transport. Next chapter, 13, is called Snail's Thoughts. After observing her snail so intensely, Bailey is certain it is just as aware of its world as she is of hers. She begins to wonder about the intelligence of the snail. She writes, "I crept through the pages of scientific gastropod literature until I got stuck on the paragraph that describes a snail's brain, which, depending on its species, has 5,000 to 100,000 giant neurons. A snail has memory. It can learn new smells, taste, and retain the knowledge of this knowledge for weeks and months, adopting its behavior accordingly. Even contemporary malacologists seem to be aware of the complexity of an individual gastropod's life." Bailey writes, "My snail went about its life moment to moment, much as I did, making decisions or being indecisive about food and shelter and sleep. She concludes that if a snail can learn and remember, then it must be able to think, at least on some level. She is convinced of this, and until someone, preferably a snail, can prove otherwise," she writes, "I will hold on to this belief, for the life of a snail is as full of tasty food, comfortable beds of sorts, and mix of pleasant and not so pleasant adventures as that of anyone I know. Snails, for the most part, lead solitary lives. Their behavior is considered intermediate in complexity, simpler than mammals and insects, but more advanced than that of worms. Bailey wonders if they communicate with each other at all. In 1871, In the Descent of Man, Charles Darwin recounts the observation of a scientific colleague. Darwin writes, "Mr. Lansdale informs me that he placed a pair of land snails, one of which was weakly, into a small and ill-provided garden. After a short time, the strong and healthy individual disappeared and was traced back, by its track of slimes over a wall into adjoining well-stocked garden. Mr. Lansdale had concluded that it had deserted its sickly mate, but after an absence of 24 hours, it returned and apparently communicated the result of its successful exploration, for both of them started along the same track and disappeared over the wall." Elizabeth wonders, did these two snails exchange tentacle touches? If so, what information was relayed through physical contact, smell, or pheromones? Wouldn't a lone snail, given the option, prefer proximity to another of its species to ensure procreation and gene survival? While contemporary malacologists do not believe that snails form any permanent attachment to one another, Lansdale's account, if true, hints at the possibility of gastropod kin selection. Since a snail too ill to make its own pedal mucus could travel more easily over its companion's trail to reach food and shelter. Bailey speculates that even if the world of the snail is soundless, this does not preclude other communication methods. She asks, how can any species, even our own, ever fully fathom by what means another species or animal group interacts? Next chapter, 14, called Deep Sleep. In 1861, Hans Christian Andersen, in the story the snail, and the rosebush describes what is perhaps the most remarkable trait of a snail, its ability to go dormant. Describing the snail, Anderson writes, "I am going to withdraw from the world. Nothing that happens there is of any concern of mine." And the snail went into its house and puttied up the entrance. Snails that find themselves in inhospitable conditions can close themselves off to the world. This can be for a matter of months, like in the winter when it hibernates, or it can close itself off for a more extended period of time. This type of dormancy is called estivation. Bailey describes the process, as the snail climbs up a planet, tree, or a wall to be away from the Earth's heat and beyond reach of predators or floodwaters. Finding a safe place, it attaches itself firmly with mucus, usually with the shell opening facing upward, which may alert it to weather changes. Then it seals up its entrance with a temporary door made of mucus. This storm door, or epiphragm, protects it from the shifts in temperature and humidity. A snail may estivate for weeks or months or even several years. For estivation, a snail will make a single thin epiphragm, but a snail set on hibernating makes a thicker epiphragm. And depending on its species and the severity of the weather, it may make several in a row to protect itself from the conditions. Bailey writes, "I could not stop thinking about the making of epiphragms. Their design is specific to snail species and its local climate conditions. They may be thin or simple or thick and elaborate. Strategically located breeding holes may be incorporated, or they may be permeable to air." There's quite an art in the construction of these little doors, and justly so. Despite their temporary nature, a good door in severe weather makes the difference between life and death for a snail. An epiphragm is also personal, and its statement is definitive. The snail is home, but it's not accepting visitors. Bailey concludes, "It came down to this. I envied my snail's many ability. I wish I could create an epiphragm at a moment's notice and seal myself off from the challenges around me. If I couldn't, like a snail, have strength equal to many times my weight, I would settle for just getting my normal strength back. If I couldn't glide straight up a wall or sleep stuck to the ceiling, I wish I could at least walk upright with the rest of my species. How wonderful it would be if we humans with illnesses could simply go dormant while the scientific world goes about its snail-paced research and wakes only when new, safe medical treatments are available." Okay. I think that's it for today. All right. We'll hopefully see each other next week. I'm having some problem here. Let's see. Okay. There we go.
Good evening. Thank you. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let the administration turn me around. gonna build a brand new world. Ain't gonna let no first strike policy turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let no first strike policy turn me around. Keep on walking, keep on talking, gonna build a brand new world. Ain't gonna let Indira Gandhi turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let Indira Gandhi, how'd you get that name? Round, keep on walking, keep on talking, gonna build a brand new world. Ain't gonna let that stinking Kissinger turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let that killer Kissinger turn me around. Keep on walking, keep on talking, gonna build a brand new world. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, and turn me around, and turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Keep on singing, keep on swinging, gonna build a brand new world.
The countdown to Halloween.
Hello, hello. It's 90.3 KDVS Davis. We're going to listen to Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around once again until I get things sorted. 90.3 KDVS Davis. Bye.
Good evening. Thank you. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me. Keep on talking, gonna build a brand new world. Ain't gonna let the administration turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let the administration turn me around. Keep on walking, keep on talking, gonna build a brand new world. Ain't gonna let no first strike policy turn me around, turn me around.